Here I am. It's all of me, and I'm staying here until I'm through. You know, when Leon and I first talked about creating a speaker series in 1997, we had just left Washington to return to our home on the Central Coast. That was 16 years ago. We knew there would be a strong appetite in this community for public forums that were balanced, informative, and entertaining. In fact, we knew that the people in our community would be ahead of the time. They would be interested in hearing both sides. The goal was to host a discussion, not a debate, to foster dialogue, not posturing. And today, I feel confident in saying that for 16 years, we have remained true to that vision. Tonight, I'm particularly thrilled to welcome back the original architect of this unique series and the original leader of these special conversations as Leon returns to the Steinbeck Forum and resumes his role as the moderator again for the Leon Panetta Lecture Series. And upon return, he brought back with him his concern about whether our democracy can function to deal with crises. He and the speakers will consider whether or not we will see 2013 as a year of continued gridlock or finally see action and compromise. It's a question that resonates deeply with us because it touches on the lessons that Leon and I work every day to teach the students of the Panetta Institute, that we must govern by leadership and not by crisis. The issues we'll discuss this season, immigration, the budget, gun control, and the turmoil in the Middle East, all represent serious policy issues that have not been resolved. Tonight, we'll turn our focus on immigration. Like most Americans, Leon and I are the children of immigrants. Our families came to this land so they could provide us with a better life. And in many ways, I think the lives we've led are the embodiment of the American dream. But alongside success, stories like ours, there are staggering statistics on the abuse and mismanagement of our immigration system. The question is, will we see conflict or compromise? Leon will ask this question of an immigration policy expert, the author of major immigration legislation, the first head of the Department of Homeland Security, and a local elected official, the son of farm workers who rose to public office. Our first guest served 30 years in the House of Representatives and was a member of the Subcommittee on Immigration, Citizenship, Refugees, Border Security, and International Law. Considered a leading voice on immigration and foreign policy, he's devoted himself to immigration reform and was the force behind some of the key legislation in this area, including the DREAM Act and the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act that he worked on with Leon. Please welcome Congressman Howard Berman. Welcome. Thanks. Our second guest is a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. She began her career at the Justice Department. In 1986, she joined the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and created the endowment's Immigration Policy Project. She then served as INS Commissioner in the Clinton administration, where she reformed the nation's political asylum system, created new strategies for managing our borders, shaped new responses to migration and humanitarian emergencies, and strengthened cooperation with Mexico, Canada, and other countries. Please welcome Doris Meisner.
Thank you. Russia. Thank you.
Our third guest was first elected to public office in 1982, becoming one of the first Vietnam combat veterans to hold a seat in the House. After five terms, he was twice elected governor of Pennsylvania before joining the Bush administration's cabinet as the first secretary of the new Department of Homeland Security. In this historic endeavor, he combined 22 agencies and was responsible for issues including immigration, border security, and emergency response. Please welcome Secretary Tom Ridge.
Thanks so much. Lovely to be with you. Thanks for everything. Thanks, all.
Thank you.
Our final guest is someone that many of us in this room know personally. He is one of 12 children born to migrant farm workers. Presently serving as Monterey County's 3rd District Supervisor, he began his public service career when he served on the Salinas City Council and later became the first Mexican-American to serve on the Monterey County Board of Supervisors in over 100 years. He went on to serve 3 terms in the California Assembly. Today, he concentrates on issues of affordable housing, immigration, transportation, community safety, economic development, healthcare, and agricultural viability. Please welcome Simone Salinas. Welcome. And finally, leading our discussion is a man we all know. He's been in Washington helping keep Americans safe for these last 4 years. But tonight, I think you'll all agree with me that it's good to have him back home. It is with great pride that I ask you to hail him back to the Institute, to the lecture series, and to the Steinbeck Forum. Please welcome our moderator, Secretary Leon E. Panetta.
Thank you. Sit down. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. It's great to be back. First and foremost, I want to thank Sylvia Panetta for the great work that she has done in keeping the lecture series going. And I want to thank everybody in our viewing audience, but particularly everybody here, for your continuing loyalty and support and dedication to the work of the Panetta Institute. I thank you very much for your continuing efforts to try to make sure that we do the good things we're trying to do in terms of building leadership for the future. So, enough to the issue of the day, immigration reform. We've got a great panel of people who know this issue and can speak to it. Immigration, it's an issue that in many ways goes to the core of what America is all about. I'm the son of Italian immigrants. Many of you are Simone is the son of farm workers. All of us, Howard, son of Jewish immigrants from Poland. And we all draw our heritage from immigrants of from one country or another. That is what America is all about. The Statue of Liberty is the symbol of America as the land of immigrants, asking that this country be able to draw the poor of the world, its huddled masses, to try to breathe freedom. That's America. That's what we're all about. And America is, without question, the largest player in immigration. More than any other country, that's what America is. So it goes to the heart of what America is about. It goes to the strength of our economy. It goes to our culture. It goes to the fabric of our society. America is a land of immigrants. If it is, and we believe that that is the case, then why the hell is immigration so controversial? Why is it that there is so much difficulty to try to establish a kind of common sense immigration system that is enforceable and that works? Howard?
Well, immigration has been controversial for centuries. There used to be signs, no Irish need apply. Waves of immigrants. Ironically, the people who had come as immigrants and had settled, angry about the next wave of immigrants, and on and over again. You add to that historic perspective, the situation, Congress in 1986 said we were going to fix the problem. And we didn't fix the problem. We had a legalization program, we put more on the border, but for various reasons we might get into tonight, there was some fundamental flaws in that approach. So you got a greater level of skepticism from the American people. But I still think that much of the fears are the fears we have seen in the past, and we're going to have to get past those fears and make this happen, because there's no other sensible alternative than taking on the issue of comprehensive immigration reform.
Doris?
Well, I would say, adding to what Howard has said, that immigration now is happening all over the country. It's been part of our history and part of our experience as a country throughout, but largely immigrants went to about six places in the country: the California, Texas, Illinois, Florida, New Jersey, New York. And even though it always was problematic and difficult to deal with, those states like California, know how to do this. Now immigration is happening everywhere in the country, and it's happening everywhere in the country because we're an aging society, we need younger workers, because of the way in which the economy has changed, competing internationally, a lot of reasons that immigration is happening in many places like South Carolina or Kansas or Iowa that have no experience with this kind of change. And it's change that's happening very quickly, they're not equipped to deal with it, and they are particularly angry about it in many ways because so much of it is unauthorized immigration. Well, that is a very, that's a thick stew, and that leads to controversy.
Tom?
It's tough to add to my colleagues, but I'd like to share a couple of thoughts with you on top of that. I want to start with an anecdote, because Howard and I were elected in 82 together, so we go back to the time when this Simpson-Mazzoli Act was passed, and I had, as a young congressman, I had one person who spent pretty much all his time on immigration issues. It was very important to northwestern Pennsylvania. And I remember meeting an individual in a supermarket who had a professional degree from another country. And so I asked him at the time, did you get a good job? And he said, no, Congressman, I didn't get a good job, but I found two not so good jobs, and I just bought my first house in America. Kind of speaks to what Leon and all of us are talking about. What is it that suddenly we've, from that mindset of 20 some years ago, when we would be welcoming people, that we suddenly turn it into the political third rail of contemporary politics? A lot of people might say 9/11. I don't think they should necessarily attribute to that. Obviously, we have to be much more concerned about people coming across our borders, but I don't think that's exactly the reason either. What I would suggest, in addition to what my colleagues have talked to you about, is that once we created that framework where we thought we were going to lawfully create an infrastructure where people come back and forth across our borders, there was an expectation of enforcement. There was an expectation that there would be a lawful, permanent means of dealing with this issue. A lot of reasons it failed, primarily because they didn't enforce it very well. There were some other reasons as well. So all of a sudden, over this historic welcoming mat, when we bring people in, you have the 9/11 experience. Then you have also people willing to say, well, they're illegal, and trying to use that as a rationale to dispute it. And then you've got 4 million people who are here lawfully with green cards waiting to get in. People are saying, what about us? And let's not kid ourselves. Was there among some people a certain bias or prejudice that may have been dealing with the ethnic or racial matters? And on top of that, there's some economic reasons. They may take my job. So if you take all of those reasons and put them together and you add on the super hyperbole associated with some of the political rhetoric, you've turned what used to be a fundamental value of America, the melting pot, Statue of Liberty, which Leon referred to, has become the third rail of politics. And this kind of discussion, I'd like to think, in the long term, suggests that a modern 21st century America, for economic reasons, for humanitarian reasons, for security reasons, the list is endless, will finally deal what you're supposed to do when you get elected to the United States Congress, whether you're Republican or Democrat. Your job isn't to avoid problems, your job is to solve them. This is an ongoing problem. I think it can be solved, but there's a little more complex than a lot of people attribute to it.
Simone?
Well, Leon, I think you hit it on the spot. It's complicated, it's complex, but I think in my family, my dad came here in 1920. He was 10 years old with my grandpa, and they worked here for about 20 years. In the 30s, with the Depression coming in, there was a directive sent out by the government, we're gonna seal the border. So all Mexicans that wanna go back, go now, or within 48 hours, you might not be able to get back to Mexico. And so he rounded up my dad, who was from Mexico, but then he had brothers and sisters that were born here, were American citizens. So they had no choice. I said, our dad's taking us back to Mexico. Comes back in the 40s when there's a need, an economic need here for labor under the Bracero program. He comes in and works during World War II in Missouri and Kansas. After that, goes back, and finally in 1955, he decided to bring the whole family, at least half of it, eight of them, and then get legal permanent residency. Then the rest of us were born here, some in Texas, some in California. But throughout all that, it's been the politics, the economics, the need here, and frankly, part of it, the xenophobia, people that don't have a clear understanding of the 2,000-mile border that's here. I mean, we had family at this site 5 minutes across the Rio Grande with other family. And we used to have a system in place out there that my dad said, if they pick him up in the morning, he'd tell my mom, I'll be back by 5 o'clock, have my dinner ready. Because all he had to do was cross, then he'd come back again. And so there was a very simple way, and there were mechanisms in place to figure out, you know, how do we stay here? How do we stay here without being detected and having family separated? That, I think, is translated here. The 1986 supposed resolution didn't work because they made it too difficult to continue with the family reunification. And I think that has compounded it. Now we have the Dreamers, folks that are young people that are saying, you know, we don't want to live in fear anymore. We want to be able to have a legal path to citizenship. And I think that's what bringing all these issues into our head, the economics, the politics, and the social issues that we have to face with regarding immigration.
Well, you've all hit the key issues. We've had wave after wave of immigrants going back to the 1600s, and there's been a backlash almost every time we went through one of those eras, whether it was the Puritans or the Quakers, the Germans, the Irish, the Italians, ultimately the Chinese, the Japanese face that kind of discrimination and backlash, and even today, Latinos and Muslims. Some of it is the result of war, some of it, you know, coming out of 9/11, some of it has been economic and tied to the recession and loss of jobs. So we know it's been a divisive issue, but in 1986, Howard and I worked on the immigration bill, and there was a consensus of Republicans and Democrats who worked together, passed the bill. Ronald Reagan signed it into law. And then there was this period of almost 20 years of very divisive politics. Couldn't get an immigration bill even taken up sometimes just to be able to negotiate it. Very divisive. And yet today, as we speak, 2013, there is a strong likelihood that we'll get some bipartisan efforts on the Senate side, perhaps on the House side, to pass an immigration reform bill. First of all, just give me a show of hands. How many of you think that immigration reform will pass in this session? Let me have the audience raise your hands. How many think that immigration reform is going to pass in this session of Congress? There's a hell of a lot more skeptics out there. Let me ask you this. I think, you know, we understand some of the reasons. Let me ask this. If Mitt Romney had been elected president of the United States, would we be talking about immigration reform? Tom?
Well, let me tell you this. I think I think the answer is yes, but the dynamics and the rationale behind it would be different. First of all, the electoral experience was very chastening for the Republican Party, as it should have been. We were unable to attract the kind of political support nationally that President Bush had done in his two elections. So, as you've commented earlier in the day, that's how we express a voice. That's how we express an opinion. That often, at least, drives something to the fore. So I think the Republicans, notwithstanding the notion of self-deportation and some of the other characterizations during the campaign, I think there would have been an impetus. I don't think it would have been quite the priority from the executive branch. But I also think it would have been a priority from within the legislature. One, there have been several polls post since January that show about 70% of American public are willing to accept the notion that it's unwise and unfeasible and probably just can't be done to send 11 or 12 million back. By the way, do they have counters? They have somebody at the border saying, okay, you're 10 million and one, 10 million and two. They've estimated like 10 or 12 million people here. You're not going to be sending them back. So let's be rational. Let's be responsible. Let's understand the world as it is, not as you want it to be, and deal with it. Secondly, I think there are strong economic reasons, and I think the Republicans' first inclination would be worried, they would be concerned about H-1B visas, the intellectual capital associated with high-quality workers. And I frankly think the Democrats would say, yeah, we agree with that, but you also have to deal with undocumented individuals and families as well. And I think that would drive it. And then finally, hopefully, it's an opportunity for the Congress to demonstrate to the rest of the country and perhaps the world that with the political support for at least legitimizing their presence, with the chastening of the election, with a need to deal with H-1B visas and maybe raising the quotas, country quotas, and maybe doing something with visa waiver, we need a comprehensive reform. One other thing I need to add, if I might. Too much attention, I mean, disproportionate attention is paid to the southern border. 40% of those who believe are here unlawfully came in with a legal visa. They just overstayed their visa and haven't gone back. So I think what's very important for the Congress of the United States and for the body politic as well to quit just focusing on Mexicans and Central Americans. This is a much bigger problem, and to your point, Doris, it's a national one. So I think we'd have done it. I just don't think it would have been as high a priority. But I think the tsunami of multiple effects would have driven it to the fore.
What do you think, Howard?
I think you say yes, Howard.
I'm way out on the limb, so you better.
For different reasons, and perhaps in a different form, perhaps not initially the comprehensive approach, I think he would have had to come around to this, not for humanitarian concerns, but for the fundamental fact that there is no other way to solve this problem. It is not healthy to have 10 to 12 million people in this country using false names, subject to exploitation, fearful about reporting crimes to the police, not working to the level of their skills because of the nature of their employment. I'll take an example from that should have some meaning here in Monterey and County. If undocumented workers were not used to plant and pick our perishable fruits and vegetables, the labor-intensive agricultural work, there would be no perishable fruit and vegetable industry in the United States. And Doris is right. This is no longer just a California issue. In Georgia, it's Vidalia onions. And I can go all around the country talking about specialized all kinds of crops. Now, we have lost some industries in this country, but do we want to be depending from an economic and national security point of view, do we want to depend on importing our fruits and vegetables as the only way of getting them to the American consumer? I think there are some concerns about that. So there are things just that are fundamentally directly in the national interest that are going to cause him. It'll change the names. He may want to do it in segments. But somewhere, a president of the United States sees this, sees no alternative answer to the problem of the status quo, and has to step up and say, we got to try and fix this.
Let me ask you this. Let's assume immigration reform passes on a bipartisan basis, as it has to. Next election, Marco Rubio becomes the candidate, Republican candidate for president. Do you think that the Latino vote will break more for Republicans in that situation?
I think all this would do, if we were able to find, as they did in 86, strong bipartisan majorities in both chambers of both parties, if you get something like that, what it does, it brings the needle of disappointment and maybe anger, but really disappointment within the Republican Party back to neutral politically. I don't think any political advantage necessarily inures to the benefit of the Republican Party because they're part of a broad-based coalition. But at least it will take, in my mind, the stigma associated with being anti-immigrant away from the party. And clearly, some of the statements that some of our leaders have made over the past several years and the actions they've taken has characterized our party, unfortunately, I think, because a lot of us feel very strongly about the need for bipartisan and comprehensive reform. So I don't think I don't think he gains anything. Well, I do think he gains anything. I think you have an opportunity to reach out to that community on a different set of issues. They don't have that bias or the prejudice, by the way, legitimate disappointment in you for failure to recognize it's a problem that needs to be solved and you had to be part of the solution.
What do you think, Simone?
Well, I think the devil will be in the details of what comes out of this. I mean, if he uses this opportunity to really address the immigration issue, to deal with the 11, 12 million undocumented folks that are here, workers, then I think he might be able to move and sway some Latinos to start voting Republican again. But again, it will depend on who he's going to be willing to take on. Is he willing to take a risk to do the right thing so that Latinos in 4 years can say, you know, he did the right thing. Now maybe we should take him seriously. But if not, I think then he doesn't get a pass. And neither, you know, with the President Obama, 4 years, we were told that he would address this issue. We understand the recession hit. He had other issues to deal with. But this time, I think he understands the Latino vote was what made a president. And he has to be able to reciprocate it and deal with this issue. So I think it will all depend on the details that come out of this. If they all do it, then I think both can claim that they finally realize this is a critical national issue and they're willing to address it.
Howard?
It's not just about the Latino population in a political context that we're talking about now. Asian Americans, a group much more likely in the past historically to support Republicans candidates for president, voted so overwhelmingly this time, and it wasn't because of the great economy. The immigration issue played a role in that. Young people of any ethnic background see their friends in school or in college, and the notion that they aren't going to be able to get a job according to their educational and talents and skills, that offends them. And employers trying to keep a business alive that depends either on some temporary workers or on a legalization problem, tired of living with the sham of employing people pretending they're legal when they know they're undocumented, they're getting upset with this. So there's a larger force here that's demanding a political answer to this problem.
Let's turn to the elements of immigration reform. Obviously some of the key elements involve border security, the issue of employers and how we verify employment for employers, the issue of deciding what kind of worker program, a guest worker program, what do we do with the skilled and the unskilled individuals, the whole issue of being able to determine citizenship. All of those are kind of key elements. Let's start with border security. Doris, you were an enforcer of the law. Can we, in fact, secure a 2,000-mile border?
Well, it depends on what you call secure. We cannot lock it down. We cannot have a Berlin Wall. We don't want that. That is not consistent with us as a democratic country. Our border is a place where overwhelmingly legitimate trade and travel takes place with our two largest trading partners, Mexico and Canada. So the issue is to manage the border. The issue is to have a border that works in terms of trade and travel, but that at the same time prevents bad things from happening. And we're basically at that point on the Southwest border. We are basically at the point now where we have invested resources as a country for at least 20 years, but particularly since 9/11, that are absolutely historic. And I'll just use this one big number that is incredibly illuminating, I think, which is that as a country, we are now spending more on immigration enforcement. It's mostly the border, but it's also enforcement in the interior. We're spending more on immigration enforcement than we are spending on the combined budgets of the FBI, the DEA, the ATF, the Secret Service, and the Marshal Service. That's our criminal law enforcement at a federal level, and we're spending 24% more than all of them together for immigration enforcement. So if anybody says that we are not seriously enforcing the law in this country on immigration, they are simply wrong, and they are not paying attention to the investments that the country has made. Now, some of this has to break through to the political class because some of this growth has happened very recently, since the last immigration debate in 2007. But even so, as I say, it's been a 20-year buildup. This kind of thing takes time. So we are managing our border, and we would manage our border a lot better if we had ways for people to come to the country legally for legitimate reasons when we need them to work in our labor markets, so that we would actually know that people that are on the border crossing are by definition bad guys, because good people would be able to actually get a visa to come here to work. If you ask Border Patrol people who are experienced, what's the single most important thing you can do to help me with my job? They'll say, get a rational immigration system.
Simone, let me ask you, on the workers coming into the Salinas Valley, have we seen a reduction in workers coming across to work in the fields?
We have, and I think what Doris was saying is part of it. They know it's more difficult to go back. Before, they used to want to go back and visit their families. Now they're staying here. They don't have documentation, but they don't want to risk having to go back and not be able to cross the border again. Plus, you know, the drug cartels are getting more into human trafficking there. It's become very, very dangerous. And yet we know we're dealing with the situation where we have families that would like to be reunited. Families, I have moms and dads that can't go and bury their son or daughter in Mexico because they're afraid that they can't get back and they've got to be able to survive. So we have seen a reduction, and that is one of the issues, as Howard was mentioning. Agriculture wants a sane system. They want to be able to know who can we hire legally here without having to go through a verification that they don't know whether the person has legal or illegal documentation there to prove their residency.
Let's talk about employer verification. I mean, generally, in the 86 bill, we developed employer sanctions or penalties and basically said that if they hired undocumented, they'd be punished. And then we required that they get at least some kind of identity, but that didn't work out very well. What went wrong with the 86 bill, Howard? And two, how do we improve the verification process for employers?
Well, my own belief is the biggest flaw in the 86 bill was that the employer sanctions were a sham. Employers legitimately said, don't expect us to be the immigration agents to be able to verify each of the people applying for a job. We said, that's reasonable. So if they present one of an array of documents or two of five different kinds of documents, and you look at them and you record that you saw those documents, we'll count that as a legitimate hire. And we did have a little bit of a job creation industry and forged documents. It became a real business. And so the pull of those jobs remained even after we passed the legislation. our choices then to do something meaningful were a little tougher. You mandate a personal identification card. Is there such a thing as a non-forgeable social security card? The technology now is much improved over what it was in 1986. We have an e-verify system that many employers are voluntary members of and who can get instantaneous reactions from the enforcement agencies and Social Security that somebody is authorized to work. Tom Ridge and Doris, we were talking about this, both say you can go even better than that in a protected way that ensures and actually enhances the privacy of individuals. You can have a biometric identifier. You remove the issue of a foreign-sounding name or an accent or as a basis for discrimination. You create a biometric identifier. It'll take some years to implement, but in the end, it offers a technological way that every employer can know that the worker who is coming to him is authorized to work, and he can't hire a person if that person is not authorized to
work. Tom, what are we talking about when we talk about biometric method of what are we talking about?
Well, I think in this instance, Howard and Doris, and I think Simone, we all agree. First of all, the e-verify system is based on documents. It is a multi-billion dollar industry, ladies and gentlemen. I've seen professional people, even with passports. I mean, it is a big business, Howard, to your point. So we need to get away from just the documents. Biometrics would be the digital photograph or your fingerprints or both. I mean, right now they have them, they can trace the veins in your fingers. They can, biometrics, they can pick up your voice. So there are ways that we can virtually assure that you are the individual who's identified in that card. And I think, to Howard's point, it serves two purposes. There are two constituencies that you need to be involved in a lawful using this infrastructure. One is the individual, bring them out of the shadows. You can register those 10 or 11 million people rather easily at kiosks and the like. So you create that database, but the other person it protects are the employers. So if you have undocumented workers who have come out of the shadows, and there's a lot of reasons we want them out of there, not just humanitarian and economic and many reasons, but it also gives you an opportunity then to go after the unscrupulous employer who chooses to hire from a labor base that's, whose authenticity is not assured through a biometric system. So my suggestion, and I think Senator Schumer, and surprisingly, Doris and I were talking about this before, he's gotten some pushback on that. I mean, it just makes no sense to me. The technology exists. There are countries around the world that are using biometrics to identify citizens. Maybe we're going to have that debate one of these days on whether or not we have a citizen's identification card. I, for one, think it would be a healthy debate, and I think good biometrics protect your privacy. But at the end of the day, biometrics are, you are the only you. It is reflected in your fingerprints, your digital photograph, and why don't we use that as a system to protect lawful workers and to protect employers who are hiring within the lawful system.
Doris, tell me about, is there a way to improve the verification system? I mean, can we really develop kind of a single system that can, you know, that employers can be able to turn to for verification?
Well, we can. It will take years. I mean, this is a long-term project, and this is something that will have to be phased in by size of employer, as well as by people themselves when they change jobs. I mean, it wouldn't be the sort of thing you would have to do all at one time. You would basically do it when you're changing jobs, register your fingerprints, et cetera. But there are even ways of hopscotching ahead of that. I mean, there are ways now through the technology where everybody could themselves call in and get their own PIN number. And you wouldn't even have to go through the card system. The PIN number then would be matched when the employer actually did the hiring. We really haven't, as long as we accept the fact that this is critically important as part of an immigration solution, the timeline I don't think is as important. But it will be a longer timeline, and there are different solutions that require different kinds of expenditures.
Yeah, yeah,
but we would have to go past what the E-Verify is presently, because that could ultimately be gamed.
No, I know. Let me tell you, we are having, at the Department of Defense, we're trying to put together the health records between Defense Department and the Veterans Administration so that you know, we will have some kind of seamless way to do it. And those are records we know. These are people we know. And we're having a hell of a time trying to get that done. First of all, the cost, the complexity, it just, you know, it's very difficult. So I know that this is a possible way to go, but it's going to take a while before we get there. We are moving now to the part where I will turn to questions from the audience. But before I do that, let me do this, as we always do. Take the time to recognize our question review team, the people who are responsible for picking your questions and presenting them to the speakers. I'll ask you to hold your applause while I introduce the entire group. Fran Gaber, who we all know has been doing this for a while, attorney with Leach & Walker. Doug McKnight, who's a reporter for KAZU Radio. Don Miller, who's editor-in-chief of the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Claudia Melendez Salinas, who is a reporter from the Monterey County Herald. And Pete Wierzbicki, who is the managing editor of the Salinas, California. If you would give them a hand, please. We also have a group of students that attended the afternoon student program. By the way, we almost had 500 students at the program today, which is a tremendous tribute to all of the speakers, but also to the issue on immigration reform. It was a tremendous turnout. What I'd like to do is to have all of the students who are in attendance tonight please stand, and will you remain standing until I recognize the schools that you represent. So please, if you'll rise. These students come from the following schools, I'll just tick them off real fast. Cabrillo College, California Maritime Academy, CSU Monterey Bay, the Defense Language Institute, the Monterey County Home Charter School, the Monterey Institute of International Studies, Monterey Peninsula College, Navy Postgraduate School, North Monterey County High School, Santa Clara University, Seaside High School, and the University of California, Santa Cruz. It was great. We had a great turnout. Have a seat, guys. Thank you. We had a great turnout today, and I want to also thank the generous support that we get from our lecture series sponsors that makes that all possible. Thank you for doing that. It was a great session, and we wanted to introduce young people to the complexities of this issue, because in many ways they are going to be the ones to decide ultimately the success or failure of whatever happens this year. Let me turn to your questions, but first of all, most importantly, for those that are interested in this stuff, the score at halftime is... depends on where your money is. And it's tight. Michigan 38, Louisville 37. So it's a tight game. won't let you know where my money is.